Good morning. My name is Ashkan Sapafant, and I would like to welcome all of you to today's first practice session on corporeality. I'm pleased to introduce our hosts for the next few hours, archaeologist Yannis Hamelakis and writer Rana Dasgupta, who will share with us respective reflections on the matters and materials posed by the notion of body within civilizational discourse. So the structure of the session involves a short impulse followed by two 40-minute lecture performances, respectively by Yannis and then Rana, after which we'll have the chance to converse together, make associations, and reflect. So Yannis Hamelakis is professor of archaeology at the University of Southampton. He researches and writes on corporeality and the bodily senses, on the contemporary meanings and social roles of ruins, and on the politics of archaeology. Amongst his books are The Nation and Its Ruins, Antiquity, Archaeology, and National Imagination in Greece, which won the Edmund Kelly Book Prize and was shortlisted for the Runciman Prize, and the edited volume, Thinking Through the Body, Archaeologies of Corporeality. His most recent book, which you can also see downstairs in the bookshop, Archaeology and the Senses, Human Experience, Memory, and Affect, was published in 2013 and has been deeply influential for the conversations we've been having in developing the positions presented by A Matter Theater. For his lecture performance today, the audio component has been prepared by his collaborator, Ethimis Theou, an Athens-based actor and archaeologist. Rana Dasgupta is a writer who grew up in the United Kingdom and currently lives in New Delhi. He works within both registers of fiction and nonfiction. His writings generally concentrate on issues of home, homelessness, rootedness, and mobility in a globalized world. His novel, Solo, winner of the Commonwealth Writers' Prize in 2010, recounts the life and daydreams of Ulrich, a 100-year-old blind man from Bulgaria. His recent book, Capital, examines the rapid urban transformations taking place in today's Delhi, and by extension, India, as part of a redistributed set of metabolic flows governing the transfers and transformations of a global body otherwise known as capital. The conversations over the past few months have been touched by a sense of connection in shared, yet conditionally divergent experiences of migration, moving between East and West, North and South, and an embodied intellectual commitment to the sense of and for the self that emerges as these movements shape our memories and give form to the stories we tell. The sensory component of what it means to be human, to take part or not in the narrative flows of civilization, and to embody a species, is what brings us together today. So I'd like to take now the next 6-8 minutes or so to just provide a little impulse reading, which is a selection of passages from the editorial essay to the publication Textures of the Anthropocene Grain Vapor Ray, edited by Katrin Klingan, myself, Christoph Rosol, and Bernd Scherer. War changes things. The cataclysm of creating this civilization at the dawn of the modern period involved a war against one world, a destruction of a certain kind of life in order for another to be created. The conquest of the Americas and the extermination of its natives and their traditions, the enclosure of the commons and the centralization of the state, the hunting of witches and heretics and their burning at the stake, the professionalization of trades and the disenfranchisement of individuals into classes, and the circulation of bodies and goods in the form of slavery and mercantilism. All acts of war, all in the name of humanity. This process does not cease renewal. Around 1943, at the climax of the Second World War, a conflict mobilizing the whole Earth and affecting changes, mutations even, that in many ways set the course toward our contemporary condition, the crystallographer, mineralogist, radiogeologist, and biogeochemist Vladimir Vernadsky would write down a few words, his final text, as it would turn out, on his concept of the noosphere. "An historical phenomenon of such power," he writes, "may and should be examined as part of a single great terrestrial geological process, and not merely as a historical process." The geological process, in Vernadsky's case, does not mean conforming to the mechanical time of continuous accumulation and superposition, a palimpsest of sedimentary layers that would aspire to history, but the organic time of the elements constantly mixing and remixing across and between the biosphere, atmosphere, hydrosphere, or lithosphere. In fact, all these spheres dissolve into the single great terrestrial geological process, with the metabolic ruptures of war sounding in the background. Vernadsky declares that the biosphere is indeed evolving, transiting into the noosphere, the sphere of human thought, through which humanity executes dominance over geological processes, scientific thought as planetary phenomenon. In the 20th century, man, for the first time in the history of the Earth, knew and embraced the whole biosphere, completed the geographic map of the planet Earth, and colonized its whole surface. Mankind became a single totality in the life of the Earth. Already in 1896, Henri Bergson had insisted that all division of matter into independent bodies with absolutely determined outlines is an artificial division. Vernadsky knew that humans were simply part of what he termed living matter, and thus part of the biogeochemical space-time evolution of life on Earth. Mankind, he would argue, as living matter, is inseparably connected with the material energetic processes of a specific geological envelope of the Earth, its biosphere. Yet man's strength lies not in his being matter. Rather, it is derived from his mind. Can his thoughts change material processes? A riddle, Vernadsky wonders, for thought is not a form of energy. Yet Vernadsky was simultaneously witness to the great devastation this creature, this lump of living matter, would be able to enact. The unspeakable destruction of spiritual and material values his wars would ravage upon his own kind as well as upon the earth. Faced with the task of life and endowed with the power of mind, what kind of a world would humankind imagine? How would it compose this noosphere? A certain state of mind, it seems, that corresponds with a world that we can now look back on and say, ah, there it is, the Anthropocene. Despite the disaster of war, Vernadsky believed not only in humans, but also in humanitas, in a particular humanism that granted the thinking faculties of man a predisposition towards the good, the reasonable, and the true. Democratic affinities and the laws of nature would ensure that the noosphere would enact an earthly paradise, a space of harmony and balance, a kind of scientific New Jerusalem. Vernadsky wished for us to face the future and to not let it go, to insist that we want to live. This is a challenge the Anthropocene also faces in the particular future it invokes. If humanitas is that which has aided the articulation of modern science and technology, is it not also responsible for having spawned the practice of war, the self-renewing onslaught of apocalypse? The legend of the Pythia has it that she was an anonymous woman, a peasant randomly chosen to play the part. Her sanctuary was a pit deep underground, found beneath the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. She sat on a tripod, uncomfortably straddling a gashing rift in the earth, a menacing abyss yawning under her. From the mouth of the underworld, chemical fumes spewed forth the vaporous traces of geothermal volcanic activity, and at times, the crack gurgled, gasped, and coughed. Usually, it was a dull roar, a gentle degree of indigestion perceptible in the bowels of the earth. Sometimes it vomited, expelling thick clouds of yellow smoke stinking of sulfur, showers of sand and ash, pebbles bouncing into the air, illuminated by dim flashes of light, the reflection of something much more ominous deep inside at the molten core of the planet. The oracle, exposed day in and day out to these terrestrial exhalations, her nose irritated by the grains of hot dust, her mind intoxicated by the poisonous vapors, her perched figure like some horrifically deformed sorceress lit up by intermittent rays of light, casting ghastly shadows in the murky cave that was her dwelling. A wonder to behold was this poor woman. Bound to the earth, as it were, in the mud, she was held in suspension between the physical reality of the earth and its fevers, the lived world of the priests and kings, and the psychic energies of the planet. Recently, geologists have started to look for signs in the ground, in the ice, or in the ocean beds marking the planet's entry into a new phase, a geological age without any precedents, the Anthropocene. Since the beginning of the most recent geological age, the Holocene, around 11,700 years, have passed, having seen the rise of human civilization and its ongoing drudgery. It is with industrialization that humans began and continue to transform the Earth's metabolism to a degree that now parallels geological forces, competing with its disasters. The diversified traces human activities have marked on the Earth will lead modern civilization to appear retrospectively as the trace fossil of the present age, layer-forming creature, an index fossil of an epoch, are the words by which Ernst Jünger, a poet of war, had already described humankind's legacy in 1959, not as an oracle, but as brutal analyst of his own narcissistic, apocalyptic times, space age and nuclear age on high. The world of the Anthropocene exhibits a mundane gravity, bringing us back down to the ground from the lofty heights of sacred history or the psychotropic rush of an acid trip, back to the trenches, knee deep. We are surrounded by war. This is a war in which what is at stake is being, or life itself. It's a metaphysical war. Before we move on to what comes as an afterthought beyond the physics, let us look at the physical situation we are in. Great evils form the groundwork of history. The news, the feed, the live stream, the status update, the flow of bits and bytes, the push notifications, our constant information flows, all bearing the quality of finitude, immediacy, disharmony. Today, planes crash and disappear off the radar. Epidemic diseases are merely managed instead of cured. Craters in Siberia open up, methane gas eruptions due to global warming, and volcanoes flowing, unstoppable, after drilling accidents. Genocidal wars are fought, occupations continue, barbarism abounds, the weather, indeed, is strange. Kids dance all weekend on horse tranquilizers. Toxic fluids are shared body between body in the nighttime capitals of Southeast Asia. Yoga workshops in California offer paleolithic snacks, primal treats. And every Monday, it is business as usual, back to work, as if the 19th century never ended. Work, capital, play. Our theater is a morning play starring a creature named Anthropos, playing across multiple streams and online channels, and using pre-recorded loops, circular feedbacks, and HD displays. Everywhere there is war, even in the happiest of gatherings, in the la-la lands of the West, paradises of artificial bounty, where the dark side of the moon finds its mirror, reflection turned topsy-turvy on its head, the glass shattered. The distorted crying faces of children in sub-Saharan Africa, the perma-white smiles of a selfie taken in Orange County, all part of the same world picture. A Nietzschean interlude. It is an uncanny feeling to whom this news may concern. When reading everywhere the chatter, Heidegger's Gerede of humanity lost, only slowly to ask oneself, Was it ever there to begin with, to lose? Or is it that we have not yet become human?